Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to The Book Show. Ramona Koval with you on ABC Radio National. This morning, we're again broadcasting to you live from the Sydney Writers Festival here down by the wharves on Sydney Harbour, and I can still see the Sydney Harbour Bridge right out the window. Today, writer David Reef with a book called Swimming in a Sea of Death, a son's memoir, a searingly honest account of a son's eye view of the death of his mother. Difficult and complex in every case, of course, but I think especially so when the mother in question is writer Susan Sontag. And in our first person reading today, John Hughes's The Idea of Home, a story about growing up in a Hunter Valley coal mining town in a household dominated by memories of the Ukraine, which his mother and grandparents were forced to flee during the Second World War. And John is going to be joining us live to read here with the audience at the Sydney Writers Festival too. Well, David Reef is the author of seven previous books on immigration, international conflict, and humanitarianism. He's been a literary editor, a journalist, and is now a senior fellow at several institutes like the World Policy Institute, at the New School for Social Research, at the New York Institute for the Humanities, at New York University. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a board member of the Arms Division of Human Rights Watch, and a board member of the Central Eurasia Project of the Open Society Institute. But his new book, Swimming in a Sea of Death, is very much rooted in his position as the only son of writer Susan Sontag. Its subtitle, A Son's Memoir, really tells the point of view of this book, and it concerns her final battle with cancer, the third time that she had fought this fight. Susan Sontag was a novelist and an essayist and a writer of non-fiction books like On Photography, Regarding the Pain of Others, Illness as Metaphor, AIDS and its Metaphors. And David Reef is a special guest of the festival. He's on The Book Show now with us. Welcome to The Book Show, David.
Thank you.
Well, for those people who don't know Susan Sontag's work, can you talk a little bit about the kind of life your mother led, the kind of writing she did?
Well, she did many kinds of writing. She was a polymath, my mother, I suppose you'd have to say. She was a critic and made her reputation initially as a literary critic and cultural critic, to use an old-fashioned term. And she was also a novelist and a filmmaker and a political activist and kind of in the old-fashioned European style, which is less prevalent in the U.S., today, and I don't know enough about Australia to know whether they're equivalent figures here. But she was interested in pretty much everything and lived out a lot of those interests, not all of them.
And when you mean in the old-fashioned European style, what do you mean?
Well, all these words are sort of poisonous and pompous, but I suppose the only way I can describe it is using at least some of them. The old European style in places like France or Germany was that you were somebody who was politically engaged, culturally engaged, and also practiced in art. And I think people of that time, in the 20s, 30s, even the 50s, I suppose, did that sort of, had that sort of idea of what they were going to do. My mother perhaps had that idea in part because she came from the deep reaches of middle America, and so for her the European counter model was probably what got her through a childhood that she wasn't very fond of by her own account. She grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and in suburban Los Angeles at a time when Tucson, Arizona was a very small town in those days, and suburban Los Angeles was a very different place than the sort of polyglot empire it is today. And I think my mother's idea in her head was to be like the people she read about at the public library in Europe. And she did it, which is no small thing.
She was a quite dashing figure, wasn't she?
That I'm probably not the best person to comment on.
But she was. She was beautiful, and she was stylish, and she was always photographed in the very well. Even her the reviews of her novels and would be accompanied with this fantastic picture of this very stylish, beautiful, dramatic woman.
Beauty is a privilege and a curse.
In what sense?
In exactly that sense.
Do you think she was cursed by her beauty?
I think beauty creates all kinds of expectations and limitations, as well as conferring all kinds of privileges.
This book begins with the news of her third bout of cancer. How do you remember what happened when you heard about it?
Yeah, I opened the book with a description of how I work in part. It was nice to hear all these foundations I belong to, but lest your listeners get the wrong idea, what I actually do for a living is I'm basically a kind of foreign correspondent, a magazine reporter, basically. And I work principally for the New York Times Sunday magazine, the color supplement. And I was in Palestine doing a job. It was the end of Arafat's tenure. Rain, whatever you want to call it. And I'd been in Ramallah for about a month trying to get a kind of story about the collapse of this period in Palestinian movement. And I have a tick, a sort of in war zones or difficult places, although comparatively speaking it was a very easy job, of not calling anybody, at least not checking in very regularly. I mean, with the internet, people can find you if they need you, but I prefer to just be on my own. And so I certainly, in the case of my mother, would tend to call her when I got out of wherever I was. And so I was changing planes in London and called just basically to say, hello, you know, I've left, I'll be back in New York soon. And she said, well, there may be something wrong, I may be ill again. And next morning, I flew back and from the UK and went to with her, accompanied her to a blood cancer specialist who confirmed that it was this very lethal, violent blood cancer, myelodysplastic syndrome, it's called. And 9 months later, she was dead. But the book is about those 9 months. It's also about death to some extent. I don't, you know, I'm not an idiot, and I'm very well aware that if people are interested in this memoir, it has mostly to do with my mother's celebrity and maybe a little bit to do with my reputation. But I mean, I don't think it's either a book only about the two people we happened to be, but it's a book trying to think through what it is to be reconciled or unreconciled to death, which I don't think is the purview of one dead and one middle-aged American writer.
You say that, thinking back, I wish I'd hugged her close or held her hand, but neither of us had ever been physically demonstrative with the other.
Well, you die as you live. I mean, it's rather difficult, you know, change those things in extremis.
That's
some people are capable of doing it, but she wasn't, and I'm not. So that's
a very profound thing. You die as you live, because there's a kind of romantic idea that when the chips are down, there's a swell, the music rises, and everybody kind of drops their masks, and the true selves come in, and you know everyone hugs, and there are tears, and that's not necessarily the case. You're saying.
I don't know what a true self is. I'm not a Christian. I'm not a believer. Seems to me a fundamentally religious idea, the true self. Seems to me people are formed by habit and by circumstance. And the habit of 52 years, I'm 55, she died 3.5 years ago, 51, 52 years, of not being demonstrative just on a basic behaviorist principle is unlikely to be transformed. Listen, some people do transform themselves. I'm talking about myself. I don't have any opinions about what people should do or what other people do. I'm describing what happened, and I don't think my mother was likely to become more physically demonstrative either. So that's the way it was. But no, I mean, the music swelling and all the deep, true feeling all coming out, I hope it happens to some people. I don't think it's very common. Just like good deaths are not very common, whatever we like to think.
On the book show on ABC Radio National, you're hearing us live from the Sydney Writers' Festival. Ramona Koval here, and I'm speaking with David Reef about his book, Swimming in a Sea of Death, A Son's Memoir. So this is the third time she gets this news, the third kind of cancer she gets. And Susan Sontag, of course, took unflinching looks at whatever she was writing about during her writing career. She spoke things that other people didn't say. She was very perceptive. The thing that one reads about in this book is that she went through this particular experience in seemingly a completely different way that she would have if she was looking at something else outside herself.
Well, she wasn't a god, she was a person. And that's God's behavior to not, to be outside yourself. It's one thing to be unflinching in one's opinions, it's quite another thing to be unflinching about extinction, particularly if you fear it as much as she did. I suspect that the difference in this third cancer, she used to refer to herself not entirely accurately as a healthy person with an unfortunate predilection for getting neoplastic illnesses. The difference is that in the case, she had a breast cancer which had metastasized through much of the lymph system when she was in her early 40s, and then in her mid-60s or early 60s, she had a uterine sarcoma. But in the case of both those cancers, there is the possibility of remission as well as the possibility of cure. I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that, either cancer was a walk in the park. And in the case of the first one, the breast cancer, her doctors at the time, this was, of course, a period in the 70s when doctors in all countries routinely lied to their patients and told the truth to the extent they were willing to tell the truth to family members only. It was very different from this kind of culture of candor, which, for better or worse, we now inhabit, culture of the internet and candor, I think of as a kind of false democracy, in fact, but some people find it very emancipatory. She was told she, or rather, I was told she was going to die, but the difference is with those two, you might get a few years from chemotherapy, say. You might not be cured, but you could live a bit longer. With myelodysplastic syndrome, with AML, with these particular forms of what, not entirely accurately, but for lack of forgive the doctors listening, forgive me, I do understand that that MDS is not leukemia, but what we call generically, colloquially, leukemias. In the case of this particular form of blood cancer, there is no remission. There's death or there's cure. And the cure, the only cure, is an adult stem cell transplant. In effect, you get a new blood system. That doesn't work very well. And it particularly doesn't work very well in 71-year-old people. In fact, they didn't even used to do them until quite recently, in anyone over 50, let alone on someone over 70, which was my mother's case. And they agreed to do it at a hospital in Seattle, Washington, where it's a very experimental kind of way out in the blue research hospital, basically. And, it's interesting for them, even if you die, to be cold about it, they learn something from your death, so they're not exactly sacrificing anything to do this operation. On the other hand, they're great doctors, and they fought very hard for my mother. I don't say this. But that induces, I think, a kind of despair when you know that there's nothing else. You're literally rolling the dice, and you're either going to luck out and the chances are very badly against you, or you're going to die and die fairly quickly. And in fact, the normal period of survival in these cancers is 9 months, and she died more or less 9 months to the day from diagnosis.
So in the book, you describe what, I mean, I got the feeling that you were almost catatonic with dread about the prospect of her dying. And
I'm often catatonic with dread.
Are you? Not now, I hope.
No, not
now. That's good.
Later.
Later. But, you know, I thought, and I was talking to you while I was reading this book, even though I have only just met you now, and I was saying to myself, David, your mother is 71, and this is her third really serious cancer. Why has this come as a kind of surprise to you that she was mortal?
It didn't come as a surprise to me. It came as a surprise to her.
So she, you know, seriously, she must have thought she's going to die eventually, but she was a fighter, obviously, and she was going to fight it. But she didn't discuss it, did she? She didn't allow a discussion about the possibility of her dying.
Well, let me start, because this gets at very strange territory, and I've obviously been touring this book for a long time, so I know where at least some questions go. And I think she had the absolute right to her own death as she wanted to die it, just as I think she had the right to her own life. So the fact that she didn't want to consider the possibility that she might die, that all she wanted to talk about and all she wanted to do, and my mother was a doer. She was a, you know, there's that great line of Goethe's, in the beginning was the deed, and I think that spoke for my mother in many ways. She wanted to fight. She didn't want to talk about the possibility of her own extinction, which she feared to a very extreme extent. I mean, she wasn't alone in this. For those of your listeners who know Philip Larkin's work, Philip Larkin was the British poet. Philip Larkin was a guy who wrote, you know, the great poem Obad about fearing extinction, about being unreconciled to extinction. I hardly think this is a novel situation. Not everybody feels that way, of course. And cancer doctors will tell you that with their patients, some want to fight at any cost and prolong their life by any amount, and some want to say, all right, I've had my run. So I don't want to be in the position, I'm not in the position of criticizing my mother's decision. Having said that, it cost me. There was a price to be paid for it, and the price was that there was no leave-taking. Now, again, leave-taking is like good deaths, I suspect, are somewhat rarer than they're cracked up to be, and probably somewhat less satisfactory than they're cracked up to be most of the time. But they're something. And obviously, that was impossible, because if what my mother wanted from me was argument support for the idea that she might survive. And so if you decide to do that, which I did, no one forced me, I decided to do that, then there are all kinds of things you can't say, including comparatively anodyne things. For example, you can't really tell someone you love them, because if you tell someone you love them in the tone of voice you use with a dying person, what you're actually saying is, I love you and you're dying. So better not to say that for the other person's sake, even if you might yourself have wanted to. It's the way it was.
You say a lot about different kinds of doctors that you met along the journey. The good doctor, I think his name is Dr. Israel, and another doctor who you don't name, and the two different approaches those doctors take. Can you talk about the differences?
Well, the book starts, I mean, shortly after this return that I described about coming back, with this visit to this first doctor, who I only identify by an initial, and it's not his initial, in fact, who is apparently a very good doctor. I mean, medical friends of mine say that this guy is an extremely able and distinguished scientist and specialist in blood cancers. He's also humanly a bit of a brute, in my view, and in my, or at least in my experience of him in that one encounter. I probably should just leave it at that. And he had no ability, he had no compassion. And in contrast, the doctors my mother then saw, both at the major cancer hospital in New York City, Memorial Sloan Kettering, it's not Dr. Israel, who is a French doctor from the first cancer she had, it's a man called Stephen Nimer, who at the time was the head of blood cancers at this Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And then the doctors who treated her in Seattle were both, I think, brilliant scientists and wonderful, wonderfully empathic, decent people.
Empathic people. In that they could tell the story that they were meant to tell your mother, that they could feel the emanations from her about what she was prepared to countenance?
No, I don't think that implies they lied. They didn't lie. They just treated her as you would want someone, as they would presumably want someone they were close to be treated. Good doctors have a funny way with all this. On the one hand, they don't lie, at least in my experience. They don't say, oh, you're going to make it. And they refuse conversations when patients and the experienced ones know how to do it gracefully. They refuse conversations when the patient says, am I going to survive, or am I going to live, or what are my chances? I mean, those are not conversations good doctors will have. They want to talk about treatment. They want to talk about options. They want to talk about the price to be paid for those things. But they manage to tell the truth without terrifying the patient more than he or she is already terrified and distraught. And that's a great human trick. Now, I'm very critical of this first doctor in this book, but this book is a description, if you want my sort of sociological opinion. I don't know how much it's worth, candidly. I think it's amazing not how many bad doctors there are in these human terms, but how many good ones. I mean, the idea that you can have a person who's a good scientist, a good clinician, and a good psychologist, that seems to be a lot to ask, particularly since physicians aren't properly trained for that, and it may not even be possible, when all is said and done, to properly train them for that. Some people are better, you know, some people have, to use the kind of cliche of our time, better human skills than others. That's the way it is. You wouldn't want a system where brilliant scientists were excluded from medicine because their empathic skills were not up to par. So I think what's amazing is how much works, not how much doesn't work, in fact.
On the book show on ABC Radio National, Ramona Koval with you, speaking with David Reif from the Sydney Writers' Festival. We were just talking about human skills there. What sort of human skills did your mum have?
She had her strengths and her weaknesses like everybody else.
I met her once. I interviewed her in Edinburgh. I met her once. She struck me as a possible... Sometimes she could be a difficult woman, I would have thought.
Unlike you or me.
That's right. Even more difficult than you, David.
Impossible. Or as the famous American film producer Sam Goldwyn used to say, in two words, impossible.
So what was the nature? I mean, you spent these last few months buoying her up, only delivering good news. Was that your job always?
I decided when I wrote this book that I would tell the truth. I would write a book in which everything I said was the truth, of course, obviously, as I understood it, as I was given to know the truth. And that anything I wasn't prepared to tell the full truth about, I wasn't going to talk about at all. That would fit under that latter rubric.
It's a funny thing to write a book about such an intimate time between two people, that last 9 months, and not talk about the nature of the relationship.
It's a funny book.
But you say she was loyal to the activity of acquiring information as one is loyal to a faith. She was on the internet. She was getting as much information as possible, wasn't she?
She was. I don't know. I mean, at first, getting all that information was terrifying and undermining rather than helpful. She managed somehow to find hope in what are really terrible statistics and prognoses. I'm not entirely clear, as I say in the book, how she pulled that particular trick off. Here I'm not being discreet or non-responsive, as the lawyers say, but I really don't know.
And you are supposed to be the cheerleader to these bits of information.
Yeah. That's what she wanted, I think.
So it must have been a sort of dissonant in your head, because on the one hand, you're a journalist, you go to places, you report what you see, you try and find the true story. And on the other hand, you come home to your mother's place and you have to don this, be in this sort of performance mode.
Oh, we're all in performance mode one way or another all our lives. I don't think we're back to the essence of people. I don't believe in that, candidly. I think we're all always performing. It just depends how hard the performance is.
You talk about not taking notes during this time. Can you?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take notes because everybody uses, you know, the shields that they're given or they have at their disposal, and the writer or the painter's shield is the work. I mean, it's a way of distancing yourself. Because the work has its own rule. I mean, there's a certain moment when writing is writing. It doesn't matter what you, if you're a professional writer, just as drawing a picture is drawing a picture, if you're a professional painter or drafts or any kind of artist. So if you start to write about it, it puts a certain buffer between you and the experience. It may also reveal things and deepen things as well, but it does permit you to put a certain distance between you. That's true. And I mean, I spent 15 years of my life, I do it a bit less now, covering wars and relief emergencies and watching a lot of people die, frankly. Not the same as having someone you're close to. I don't mean it that way, of course. You know, the writing serves as a way of keeping yourself from feeling too much, at least in the short run. And I didn't want to avail myself of that particular privilege. I didn't think it was the right thing to do. I can't really tell you exactly why, but it's the way it seemed to me at the time.
I'm going to invite some questions from the audience. So if you've got some questions you'd like to ask David Reif, you can just stand by these microphones that are just by each of these pillars. You talk about her journals, though, reading her journals. When did you read those? Was that afterwards?
As opposed to snooping before. Yeah.
No, that's not the only way. That's not the only possibility,
she,
is it?
I read them after she died, you know, because she died in this odd way. She died as a person not really... By the time she really accepted the fact that she'd lost, she was so damaged by the treatment, by the shutdown of the body that comes with imminent death, I'm talking about a few weeks before she died, that she really wasn't in a position to make rational, lucid, informed choices about what she did with her, what she wanted done with her work, what she wanted done with her effects. She had a very cursory will, but I really had no indications of what to do. So at that point, I read the journals, or somewhat later, I read the journals, and it was a difficult experience, in a, I suppose, quite predictable kind of way.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, it's a whole life that was, you know, one I mean, in some sense, one got to read her side of the story.
And you hadn't heard that before?
It's not the same thing. It's not the same. Besides, hearing something from someone is about their tailoring what they're saying to you, to the other, to their interlocutor, both Maybe they're doing it to spare you. Maybe they're doing it to hurt you. Maybe they're doing it to show off for you. Maybe they want to minimize things, whatever. But a journal is, I mean, a journal that's not conceived of as for publication, which these journals very much, they are such journals. They were not meant, she was not writing with a view to their being published. They're unvarnished in a certain way, uninflected by those other things.
But were they very much the basis for her fiction writing?
No. They're workbooks that are... They're mostly personal.
They're different from workbooks.
They're mostly personal. Anyway, they are going to be published. And people will have a chance to read them. I mean, pieces of them, a selection of them.
You're editing them.
I've edited the first volume, which will be out in the U.S. in the winter of... In February of 2009, summer of 2009, in this country, and in the U.K. and elsewhere in the world. I have no idea when, but within a while. And then two more volumes will come out in the following 2 years.
So when did I start this one that's coming to be published?
Starts in adolescence and goes through till she's about 30, I guess.
So you say they weren't written to be published, but you are going to publish them.
Made you make that decision? Because while she was well, she sold her papers, journals, and books, she had an enormous private library, to the University of California in Los Angeles, and they were going to become public anyway. So I decided, while I'm still around, I'd do them.
Because?
Because I think I'll do them better. Because I got a chance to throw a few things out. No.
I think you did, though, David, didn't you?
No, actually, I didn't. The journals, as you will, as those of your listeners who, and you, if you're curious, will see, are unvarnished to a point that I regret. But there was no other option except not publishing them.
Did you learn anything about her that you didn't know?
Sure.
What did you learn?
You can infer that from these journals. I'll draw a veil over that, as Mark Twain used to say.
We've got a question from the audience.
Thank you. As someone who probably, like everybody in this room, has been close to people who have gotten bad diagnoses, I'm just curious, both as a journalist and as someone who cares about those people, how could candor be a bad thing? You talked about how doctors in the 70s wouldn't give you the full story, and how now the culture is openness. And just as someone who has to deal with diagnoses of loved ones, how would you not want to know everything you possibly could? How could that not be a good thing?
Well, if you're really afraid of dying, it might be a good thing for the loved one to know, but I'm not sure it's a good idea. I don't think it's an unmixed blessing for someone terrified of death to be told that their chances are very poor.
Because then they don't get a choice. Once you know, you know.
Yeah, it's Promethean knowledge in the obvious definition. So, I mean, you know, being told... Look, there's a wonderful... Another person like my mother, like Philip Larkin, who is absolutely terrified of extinction, was the German language writer Elias Canetti. He was the citizen of so many countries that it's difficult to actually describe his nationality. And Elias Canetti wrote a play in which the premise of the play is everyone's walking around with a kind of sign hanging from their necks with the age at which they'll die. And the premise of the play is how terrifying that would be. We all know we're going to die, but the fact that we don't know exactly when makes life bearable. To be given a death sentence, or effectively a death sentence, I can hardly view that as just a good thing. Anyway, I'm not somebody who thinks candor is the highest of all virtues, to put it mildly, as this interview may have demonstrated in a kind of real-world way.
Annie Leibovitch was a sometime partner of your mother's.
She was.
And in your book, you refer to some pictures that she took of your mother as she was dying and when she had died as posthumous humiliation. Did Susan Sontag approve of the taking of these pictures?
Well, Susan Sontag was dead for most of the pictures that are published in that book. So obviously she
could have approved beforehand.
She didn't think she was going to die, as I've said several times. So, I mean, the idea that she would have approved, she would have not made provision for how her own work and everything else, of which she was intensely proud, would have been published, but permitted these pictures of herself looking absolutely monstrous and then looking dead is not likely. In any case, listen, I don't talk about Annie Leibovitz apart from the sentences I've used in the book, which are, I think, two. But I will say this, that Annie Leibovitz gave an interview in The Guardian in London in which she said, I know Susan would not have wanted me to publish these pictures, but I had to do it. I think that's the answer to that question.
Towards the end of the book, you struggle with this idea that, and you say, as for someone who so full of life and so a lover of being alive, you say something like, I'm paraphrasing here, how come she had to die, someone who was a great lover of life, and I think you say that you don't feel like that about life. You're not as thirsty for life as she was.
Yeah, look, I think that guilt rational and guilt irrational just go with the territory of grieving for people you care about. I don't think some of it is reasonable because we all have things that we do that we have every reason to feel guilty about. And some of it is completely irrational. You wish basically you'd been a doormat because you think about the person, you say, well, why did I not do what he or she wanted when that person is now dead? And of course, you can't live that way. I mean, one of the quotes that I use repeatedly in the book is a line of Kierkegaard's where he says that life can only be understood retrospectively. The problem is it has to be lived prospectively. And, you know, so it's a ludicrous counterfactual to say you could have done something else. All I meant by that, beyond the kind of guilt, which is just what it is, and I do say what you say, but I also say how absurd I know that statement to be. It's simply a fact that my mother loved the world a lot more, not just than me, but than perhaps many people. And it's harder, as the Stoics taught us, and, you know, the more you love something, the harder it is to lose it, and since you lose everything in the long run, that makes it hard.
Well, David Reeve's book is Swimming in a Sea of Death, a Son's Memoir, and it's published in Australia by Melbourne University Press. Please thank him for being on the book show.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.